Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture podcast. Today we have a unusual choice of guest, and I'm not sure exactly where this conversation is going to go, but I'm talking to Khalil from the Philippines, who has an unusual perspective. He has had some experience with formal agricultural scientific research, but he is also a very widely read and deep thinker on the pressures that face societies and how we adapt and evolve to them. So maybe you want to introduce yourself and see how badly I did at trying to summarize who you are.
Well, thank you so much, Shane, for inviting me in this conversation. Yeah, it's strange because after moving around different domains, it's like I would have to think of like how I should introduce myself to a certain person from a specific perspective. When I'm talking to entrepreneurs, I talk about my entrepreneurial background. When I'm talking to people in anthropology, it's like, okay, I'm interested in this particular thinker, but I have no idea who I'm talking to right now. Like who is your audience? Maybe we could talk, I could introduce myself through where we got in contact, which is that recent essay I wrote for Seeds of Science on psychofauna studies, wherein I presented this way I'm trying to approach culture, which is to view them as beings rather than just lifeless things. And I mean, I go through why I do that in that essay, but I guess that's a good way to introduce what I'm working on right now. I'm currently, my main work right now is really writing. It's like you do that every morning. I'm writing a book right now on, it's my first work of fiction, which is fictionalizing this historical event when Ferdinand Magellan met our local Raja here, Raja Humabon, and Magellan was killed during that in 1521. And there's really it's such a strange story. But then when I started to imagine Raja Humabon as a modern Filipino politician, so things just made sense. Anyhow, that's my main work right now. I'm still continuing to run the business I built in the past 10 years. You know, I talk about techno-capital in that essay. And maybe there's one thing I could bring in this conversation. Working a lot with techno-capital in the past 10 years, I feel I have some familiarity with this psychofauna and how it molds people's minds and our how we view status and social structures and power and all that because of its own intent to spread itself. And that might have some relationship with agriculture in this thing you're trying to do. I mean, I don't understand it yet. So maybe this
There's a resonance there. There's a resonance there. That's why I wanted to get an opportunity to talk to you more. Just for the audience as well, another thing that made you really jump out to me is that you actually spent some time in your past doing a formal research project on cacao genetics, which I think then led into you doing cacao plantations and chocolate entrepreneurship businesses. So do you want to just briefly tell us the lingering effect of your time in formal scientific academia? Mm-hmm. How has that impacted you, and how do you now see the kind of scientific edifice, this great church that is crumbling around us?
Yeah, I mean, I think the origin of this journey might also resonate with you, since I see your work. I mean, what I sense from the book you sent, and your social media presence, I sense that you are working outside of the, you know, this world that techno-capital created, no? And yes, so the origin of this was when I read this book by Liz Gilbert entitled Big Magic. It's a guide for creative work. So there's a technique there on listening to muses, essentially. She has a different way of explaining it. It's treating ideas as beings rather than like just some, I don't know, abstract thing in your head. And I tried it out. And then, you know, it's like I was just for the sake of like, you know, just some new productivity technique. But like one day or one, what's it like, 4 a.m. in the summer of like, when was that? 2019, I think. This idea, which I treated as a being, was just like so clear. It's like Kakao was calling me for some reason to bring it to like this modern world. And I was following this idea of like Liz Gilbert. Okay, it's like, okay, let me listen to it. Let me see where it will take me. And during the time, it's like, you know, I was just like following all these serendipities. Like I would meet some another Kakao person in a cafe. We got to meet, and he came from like Canada or something. And then he, because of that, I was able to go to this Kakao farm in a nearby island. And this guy was, what you call this, like collecting seeds, cacao varieties, which we got from Mexico, which are different from the agribusiness cacao varieties that we have now in the farms here. He wanted to preserve them. And when I took the chocolate made from the cacao, from like the they call it criollo from Mesoamerica, brought by the missionaries that came here. And it just like it took me back to my childhood when my grandmother would make this cacao drinks from her backyard, from the same, like, what you call this variety there.
Kind of a heritage
So, I mean,
variety, yeah.
yeah, so at the same time, so I had this whole cacao journey. At the same time, I was also like, I was just sort of bored, sort of bored with business. It's like there was this part of my brain, my mind, which was hungry for something technical. I mean, I studied engineering back in college. So there was this part of my brain which was like not being nourished, which was like hungry for something technical. So when I read this book, The Gene by Siddhartha Mukherjee, I was just like sucked into this world. So I thought, okay. So I took a master's actually in biology, focusing in genomics. And I thought, okay, maybe I could just combine cacao with genomics. So I started reading up on cacao genomics. I was fascinated by this new genetic sequencing technology called nanopore sequencing, which uses a new technology. Very fascinating. If you look into it, it uses this biological structure called the nanopore, and you know, use and combines it with like measurement of like
Like
what's it called,
little nano
electrical
sensors. Yeah,
signals.
little nano sensors on
Yeah,
either side with the electrical
yeah.
impulses. Yeah.
It's insane. So I'm like, okay, I wanna just have an excuse to study this. So I was preparing for like a thesis on using that for local cacao, for some sort of like maybe like flavor or whatever. I just wanted the excuse to explore cacao from that perspective. But then the pandemic happened. And then it was just like, instead of like feeling like a victim, it was like I have no choice here. That was all that gave me like an opening. Like there was a lot of like students and scientists all over the world who felt the same way I did. It was like I have to contribute to this, and it ended up like I gathered a team from all over the world through this platform for volunteering, and we had a project where we were going to bring a nanopore sequencer in the Philippines to sequence SARS-CoV-2, which happened like, and we were actually featured in CNN. So that was the whole like insane like journey of genomics. So yeah, that's how. But then after that, I was like, I wasn't able to return to cacao genomics. Like things just went other ways and all that. I lost that voice from that muse for some reason. I don't know. I was going to write a book instead. But yeah, that's the funny thing with this, with these like voices and inspiration, like some other voice just suddenly comes. It's like, you know, it's like I think this is the voice I need to follow or whatever. So I'm still figuring out like how do I engage with these ideas, with these beings. And so far it's like right now I'm committed to this book, Raja versus Conquistador, which will take maybe a few years to complete, but it seems to be the right way. I don't know if I answered your question or if I brought that to a direction, interesting direction.
Just as an aside, am I right in thinking that the global cacao industry is in a bit of a crisis at the moment, that there's huge plantations of relatively limited genetic diversity that have been planted around the world?
Yes. Yeah, there are several problems. I mean, when you go into a d domain, you're start very romantic about it. Like, it's once you're there, you see the realities of the situation. So I think the two major problems of the cacao industry right now is the situation in West Africa, and also maybe less with the genetic diversity compared to bananas, for example. Like for bananas, like maybe 99% are like this. What's the variety? Cavendish. And for a Filipino, it's like the worst tasting banana. It's just it's bred for like because it has thick skin. It ripens slowly, so you could export it. It's just essentially bred for export. But it tastes terrible. I mean, like, we have so many other bananas here. But anyhow, I mean, the situation, genetic situation of what you call this cacao is much better than that because we have our own varieties here. Even the agribusiness varieties here were developed locally. The old varieties, which we got from South America, Mesoamerica, are still around. So, but the bigger problem really is like the situation in West Africa, wherein, it's almost slave-like. There's a monopsony. Their only buyer is the government, and the prices are dictated. I think in the trading port in the Netherlands or something like that. It's a messed up situation. So and then the global prices are set by them. So our farmers here are sort of limited by that as well. So yeah, it's just like a huge mess right now. Yeah, it's hard to, yeah.
If you ever want to do an experiment in cognitive dissonance, you point out to somebody that the chocolate bar they're eating was probably picked by African child slaves, and you can watch the actual process of them sweeping that information under the rug so they don't have to think about it.
So I went deep into that world and like, it's like I don't feel I have anything to contribute here, except maybe like writing. Maybe that book will be around, you'll still be there in the future. I don't know. But cacao is a fascinating plant, including like the its effects on cognition, and like, it's in the, also its history. So maybe a book will be there in the future. Well, we'll see.
I'm very fascinated by the theory that civilizational golden ages often coincide with the mass consumption of caffeine for the first time. They've happened in ancient China when tea became like commonly, it used to be like, it's been around for a very long time, but there was a period when it became a mass commodity that like pretty much everyone was getting buzzed. Same with the Islamic golden age and obviously the Renaissance in Europe, where they had tea, coffee, and chocolate all turn up pretty much simultaneously.
Yeah, I'm unfamiliar with that, what you call it, with the story. So, but that's fascinating. Yeah.
And it makes you wonder about the impact of other, for want of a better word, psychoactive substances in the evolution of civilization, because the first grain was used for producing beer, like low grade alcohol, and people living in cities from like the earliest point in agriculture were drinking fermented grain instead of water because it was safer. So, wonder how much of that early cast of civilization relied on everyone being just slightly tipsy. Is it easier to put up with like sickling barley all day long if you're feeling a little bit, if you're getting a buzz from your lunch?
Yeah, well, the this reminds me of Michael Pollan's. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I was more focused on theobromine, and it's milder than caffeine, at least in my experience. But a lot of like what you call this cacao. There's also this. You also see like different groups of like cacao related people. That you have like the chocolate makers. You have the farmers. You also have this like cacao. What you call this ritualists? I mean, it's a modern Western created ritual, which, and one thing they mention is how cacao opens up the heart. And I've had personal experiences where like that seems to be true. Like you seem to be, I don't know what mechanism that is. Might maybe similar to MDMA, and like you're more the openness side of people as like expanded or something like that. I don't know, but there's definitely a psych component of cacao.
It's a fascinating crop, and there's a lot of diversity of barely domesticated wild species in the genus. Like the potential for doing really wild, wide hybridization with it to take the crop in other directions is, I don't know how much attention it's actually getting.
Yeah, well, there's like a chocolate, what you call this? A group of chocolate makers who are like, who prefer the non-varieties, well, optimized in the sense of like, agriculture, like systematic agriculture, because like, I mean, there are just more varieties of flavor in these, like, what you call this, which older varieties. By the way, like, maybe you could give me like some idea of this world you're coming from. It's like, what is low input agriculture?
So it's basically looking at the pre-industrial agricultural past where you didn't have, rock phosphate coming in on steamer ships, and you didn't have synthetic nitrogen to kind of hypercharge all of your productivity, all the machines to like transport all the material everywhere and completely change the economic dynamics between farmers and consumers, with a view that at some point industrial civilization is going to run out of the easy energy that has characterized the last couple of centuries. So the future is likely to look quite different from the recent past, the last century or two.
And your audience for this podcast are mostly from that world?
I mostly started out talking to amateur crop breeders around the world, and most of those, the ones that I've found, home growers, where they have very different goals and pressures compared to an industrial farmer who's, growing a commodity crop.
Yeah, because like my younger brother is also sort of in this world. It's like he is planting his own cacao. He goes to his little farm in the mountains every weekend. He's also an artist. He creates clay, what you call this, sculptures. So he's also, I mean, that's I sense like he, I mean, he is also like maybe inherently, maybe he's because of his personality, he is not captured by techno capital. I mean, it's always been like that. And one angle was thinking about like what would be the intersection that we could talk about, in this conversation. I thought that,
Well, the next big topic we can move on to is your idea of, what was it, psychofauna, particularly psychic megafauna. It's this wonderful, let me see if I can summarize it. It's this wonderful, I guess you'd call it a biomimetic theory, that human cultures, the way ideas and human choices emerge and coalesce on a mass scale, in many ways mirrors how material and energy flows function in a food web, that you get all of these little entities at the low level. You've got the bacteria and then the plants, and then all those resources get concentrated and concentrated until you end up with something like a woolly mammoth stomping around the landscape and influencing all of the things below it in a kind of catalytic way. And even evolution, but it behaves in a similar networked way. You get all of these little changes that gradually get pulled together through natural selection, until you end up with large, functional, persistent structures.
Yeah, and these structures are like alive and we consider them individuals, right? I mean, this is not a new idea that like comparing ideas to living beings, Durkheim was already sort of doing that, but didn't do it all the way. Dawkins, coined a meme, which is like an analog to genes. So, but what I'm saying is like, there might be something, it might help us think better if we also consider these ideas that, develop in the meme space as living beings. Like what's, like why do we consider something living, right? Because like living, like compared to dead non-living things, like living beings change the environment around them for their survival and reproduction, right?
And
Like any animal.
they accumulate useful information over generations as well.
Yes. So there's a way for them to capture information in biological beings. That's the genome. So essentially, the genome is like a record of what kind of body could operate successfully within a certain environment. And that is updated because of like death and reproduction, testing out different varieties, variations, small variations of that. So you could get a, like essentially evolution. Like you have various instantiations of living beings fit for different kinds of environment using different styles of survival, but each of them has the same thing. It could change its environment. It could rearrange matter so that it could survive and reproduce. But the thing is, like if you look at ideas or look at these cultural forces that emerge from human minds, I mean they're the same thing. They also change their environment. No, it's like this cultural forces was already like observed as early as like the 20th century when the domain of sociology and anthropology started. It's like, hey, these are like cultural forces, right? Religion, nations, movements. These big ideas, like the what postmodernists call meta narratives. I mean, they influence us on a very like deep level. No, like how we view the world influences how we humans operate the world. Therefore, these big cultural forces could influence, through us and how we operate within the world. And if they are like living beings and they operate like animals or plants or microorganisms, then that impulse is towards their own growth and survival and reproduction. So, for instance, one example I mentioned in this conversation and also in that essay is techno-capital, right? It's like this being is one of the most powerful in today's world. No, it's like it just grows, continuously, and especially like maybe around 500 years ago, with what you call the scientific revolution. And this has accelerated the creation of like new technologies, which helped it spread further. Also, the growth of like even like the invention of the number zero, or the discovery of the zero, because like enabling the mathematics that could, what you call this, underpin all this expansion and coordination of different, like what you call this, desire, production, distribution. This is all those things had to be there for techno capital to be unleashed and become this major force.
Would
Now, I
you
think,
think that you could compare Silicon Valley to the Cambrian explosion?
well, maybe not only Silicon Valley, because I think it goes much further than that in what you call this, in history. Like, since I'm studying anthropology, like a lot of our examples of cultures are like pre-modern societies. And you can see there, if you look at it from the perspective of techno-capital, you could not expand outside that society until you have like that's just, those societies were basically dominated by an older psychofauna, which is like wherein you have the alpha, the king, just being like serving his own interests. You have slavery, you have ritual sacrifice. I mean, this all these things make sense once you see like how power operates in that world. Like the power is the primal, what you call this, perspective. No, people, the world, their worldview is shaped by this powerful man. And his worldview is shaped by the desire for power and stay in power. But something happened, like in the past few thousand years. Maybe it's through the Axial Age religions or whatever, that, like ritual sacrifice ended, slavery eventually ended. And, this idea of like the equality of all men and women, that we must side with the weak. I mean, these are ideas I got from René Girard, this French American social theorist, that once you had that, truth could now be could have supremacy over power. It's like if you have, you could not just kill someone because he disagrees with you. So people could speak the truth without fear from the alpha. So that also was required to unleash like science and technology, like operating in the world based on a accurate model of reality versus like myths, which are really, how do you describe myths? It's like operating systems that work without knowing the mechanism behind it. So science is like knowing the mechanism of this world. So that's.
A myth is a bit more like a reflex. Like it's a usually useful reaction that's processed. I mean, so subconscious, sometimes it's in the spine. Like the brain doesn't even get a look in as your hand jerks away from a spine or a hot object. And I feel myths are kind of like that. They function, but at a subconscious level, whereas we've gradually, through the process of the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution, we've dragged more of that into our awareness bit by bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's the, what you call this, the interpretation of Girard. It's like a Darwinian interpretation that it's just basically a trial and error of societies around the world. And the ones that survived had myths that allowed them to survive. So the reason why there's similarity of myths across the world, I mean, it's kind of strange because, there wasn't like internet back then. You couldn't just talk to each other, but there's similarities, like myths, like also like the ubiquity of like ritual sacrifice. It's kind of strange. Like, why would everyone actually do that? So, I mean, the using a Darwinian logic is like, okay, this must have contributed to the survival of societies. So, I mean, they sort of work. But it's like a pre-scientific, maybe like what you call this, maybe like traditional medicine. It's like some of them work. We don't know why. We just continue using them. So there's no mastery over the actual mechanism. Therefore, you could not invent new explanations and knowledge and technology based on that understanding because it's just like tradition that this thing works.
I have a really interesting question for you, just completely off the side. Do you think the practice of modern genomics and genetic technology is some percent mythology? Because I'm kind of skeptical about, like, I lived through the Human Genome Project coming out versus what they were promising and what we actually got. And I like to think, I'm not a trained geneticist, but I've got a biochemistry background. And my position is that we tell ourselves that we have more power and understanding than we really do. What we actually have is just a really huge pile of ATCG with very limited ability to pull useful information out of it. Not zero, but a lot less than we imagine that we do or we will shortly have.
But I think all these big movements need to be myths or mythologies.
At
Like
least to
for you,
begin.
yeah, I mean for you to like gather that amount of like energy and focus of human beings, it has to be some sort of religion. It's like it has to be a belief system, like even like bringing a man to the moon. The importance of like technological progress, And this stem from, I mean, these are like choices of what, how to view the world at the, you know, so even like the belief in science, you know, these are fundamentally choices of how we view the world.
Do you know what it reminds me of? I just read and reviewed a book, Design in Nature. Fascinating book. But one of the points he was going on about is that animals get more energy efficient as they get bigger, which allows them to like move further and operate differently in the environment. And human culture almost functions like that as well, too. There's these unifying signals that make us all push in the same direction at the same time, and it allows us to achieve more outcomes more efficiently than if we just randomly wandered around on our own. It's almost like a, you know, the proteins that stick cells together, or the hormones that make them all react at the same time, or the nerve impulses that make them all twitch at the same time. That those are the ingredients that you need to make a functioning animal. And there's cultural equivalence to that as well too. And it allows human cultures to climb over mountains together that they couldn't do individually.
Yeah, definitely. And if you like just compare, I mean, if you look at it in the Darwinian lens, I mean, the societies which have a bigger, what you call this, could organize bigger units will overtake the ones with smaller units. Now it's like, and these ones will be incorporated into this bigger system. And you know, right now we have been seeing that like modernity has essentially like overtaken all of the world. You know, there are just very few, what you call this, groups of people who have escaped modernity. So because, I mean, I suppose the one way of seeing it is because it's a more efficient system. You know, it's just like you know, it's a bigger system, and you know, that's what has happened.
I look at modern industrial civilization as like one of those really huge trees that manages to grow in a forest, and it casts so much shade that you only get like a couple of ferns and mosses that are managing to hang on underneath it. But it's monopolizing so efficiently all of the sun, all of the minerals, all the rainfall, that there's almost nothing left for anyone else. And it's funny, like our modern culture can look at nature and be in awe of something like that, but then the same culture looks at industrial civilization and is horrified by it. And it's the same basic phenomenon. And eventually that huge tree will fall over and it will be a big disaster and disruption to the forest. But maybe the thing that makes industrial civilization different is that there's really only one of them and it's spanning the whole planet. So when it finally reaches the end of its life cycle, the disruption is going to be, at least on a planetary scale, more or less total.
We'll see. Well, because like the difference is like we are conscious of it. So like humans know what's happening, and you know, the optimist view is that, hey, we could fix this, no? We could, there's some way around us. We could see the danger coming. You know, because like what could you do? Like you couldn't just wait, stand there and like wait for the destruction. It's like, you know, there must be a way to fix this.
I
But
very
you know,
much I very much used to be in the pessimist camp, and I still am, but I'm much more hopeful about different forms of society that can happen on the far side of industrialization. I think that, I mean, look at how transformative the collapse of Rome was. Like, Rome brought a lot of new, cultural forms and technology and ideas and people, and like scrambled up the whole Mediterranean region. And when it fell, there was a lot of like pain and disruption, but it left little seeds of new possibilities all over the place. And if it had never fallen, would we have had the scientific revolution, or would have they just been happy being Roman forever?
Yeah, you know, like this what's called this direction. I'm constantly fighting against this in my writing, because I mean, we're now talking about this global solutions and like this, and I feel like, what you call this, there's a solution right now for individuals, for people. No, it's like this is the, I mean, imagine Rome. Rome is there, but it's like these things are bigger than each one of us, and like very few individuals have the luck or maybe the curse to have the power to actually make like to directly work with these big entities and fight in that war, the battle of big entities. So now it's like I was thinking like what's the if I'm gonna
I would
write.
point out too that you're more likely to influence the trajectory of those big structures when they're early in their growth process, but once they've kind of reached their peak, they're pretty much running on momentum. That's why, personally, at this time in history, I'm much more interested in setting the seeds, little tiny durable seeds for completely new kinds of society and civilization in the future. I think that's where you can be much more influential. I mean, it's very high risk, very high reward, but maybe I'm just a gambling kind of personality in that regard.
But and also it's like it's just like you're a citizen of this of Rome right now. And like I don't know, like it's you have to be clear of what you want in life, because it's like these are just part of the cards you are dealt. Like this is techno-capitalist is like the dominant psychofauna right now. I'm living in the Philippines. I have to also deal with this entity. Various ethno-linguistic groups are here as well. But what am I called to do? No, it's like, and then these are just like, this is the situation I have to deal with. And I think that's like the what, because I mean, I may have a more, what you call this, sympathetic view of this creature, techno-capital, because like I've been working with it for like 10 years versus like those, the people I know who operate outside it, it looks like a monster to them, I imagine. Like this, just destroying things and all that. I think because it's, I see it just as an animal. It doesn't have consciousness, so it just wants to grow and replicate. No, but as a human being, we could see that, and we could, like for instance, we treat animals in a certain way. We know that they just want to grow and survive. But we could deal with them. I think this you could deal with this as an individual. Not just thinking about like someone who works in the government as an individual. To make use of its power for your own purpose. I mean, you could collaborate with it if you, as long as you understand it, what it wants, you could sort of like make use of some of its energy for what you want to achieve in life. And this is where I was wanted to like explore. Tell me what you think about this, because like the what you call this, the situation with non-industrial agriculture is that. The way I see industrial agriculture is that the knowledge is like why would techno-capital like industrial agriculture? Like what's in it in that system that makes techno-capital more likely to work with it? I mean, it's basically been the version of agriculture that techno-capital has cooperated with and has developed, no? And I think it's because the knowledge of agriculture that allows, the growth of plants and animals is captured in what you call this in external bodies, no? Like for instance, a piece of genetically modified crop or a piece of technology, a system. These are all external embodiments of an agricultural knowledge. Because of that, it's easy to replicate, no? So it's just like you just easily copy that. So versus like for instance, like my brother, he knows a lot about agriculture, but it's in his head. So it's he couldn't replicate him. He couldn't just so just in terms of like if me, I'm techno-capital, it's like I'll choose this easy to replicate system because it will it is more compatible with me. But now this is the interesting thing.
Just a quick
Because
aside, is it an issue of legibility? Because it reminds me of a story that I heard about the Philippines. You can correct me if this is wrong, from seeing like a state that when the Philippines was colonized, it was in some ways like medieval towns where people just had first names. Like nobody had surnames. And they actually sent government officials from town to town with a big like phone book from some other part of the world and said, okay, everyone in this town, you've got this surname. And there's still evidence of that today because there's been only so many people that have moved long distance. Is that actually true?
It's a Claveria degree. If you see like a state, you want access.
Yeah,
If
you
you
have
need
to,
access,
you need a map that's simple enough that you can manipulate it.
So you need to know who has paid the taxes. So for that to happen, you have to have names which could be traced. So from the point of view of the state, it's like that's the use of the names. In terms of like the is it about eligibility?
Well, like
Let's
if
see.
you try and sell a new variety of apple in Australia and in most Western countries, it's really, really difficult because people see the name on it, they don't know what it is. They want it, it's like the Cavendish banana. They don't care that it's crap. They just want consistency. They just want to know they're getting what they think they're paying for. It's like McDonald's. Like it's not particularly good food, but it's always the same. That's the selling point. And I think in industry, scalability relies on that homogenization in order to operate at mass scales. Whereas non-industrial agriculture, it's all about every little pocket of land on the planet has different genetics of different crops that all have different management, and the system can't scale that in any way.
I think the what you call this, the legibility and the uniformity is really just a result of the primary requirement from the point of view of technical capital that it has to be replicable. And for it to be replicable, it has to be the information, the knowledge has to be in like encoded within a physical system outside of the human brain. Because like I'm this is like what might be interesting, no? Because like what could be a future where techno capital would prefer the smaller entity, no? Because right, like the
Do you
like a
suspect?
parallel.
Do you suspect that improvements in like machine learning and robotics could actually allow like processing plants to deal with fruit that are all different shapes and sizes and that
That's
can't just be
exactly
ran?
where I was going. That's exactly where I was going. But first, let me share a parallel, no? Like the music industry in my place was transformed by technology. So it used to be less like this big record labels in Manila, no? So I'm from Cebu. We speak a different language. Manila, there's like the national language. So it's been always been sort of like annoying to us that like all the music produced is from from this big what you call this record labels in Manila, most of it in Tagalog. But because of like it became cheap to actually record at home, you have a laptop and it's like you don't need a big studio. So in the past like 10, 20 years, there's been so much regional music in regional languages here. So my guess is, now that computation and intelligence becomes cheap, so you don't need the what you call this, the knowledge to be encoded very rigidly within these systems, these technologies of like industrial agriculture. So, like your knowledge, my brother's knowledge, could be what you call this, like replicated in like AI. And because the advantage, I mean, the main disadvantage of this monocropping is like this major black swan disasters. No? So if you have more diversity, it's actually better for the entire system. So if I was techno capital, it's like I would choose this if it were cheap. And now it may be cheap. It's easier to execute that because of like it distributed artificial intelligence, it's like so that might be the future wherein techno capital is still dominant, but it would choose diversity over like monocropping.
It's interesting too that the issue on the consumer side often comes down to uncertainty. But for example, if you had really, really diverse fruit in a supermarket and there was some way of like remotely assessing the sweetness and the acidity, without you having to buy it and bite into it and maybe be disappointed, that could potentially allow diversity to be compatible with, you know, whatever is the future of industrialization. So yeah, they're really interesting ideas. Like, this is why I wanted to get you on. You got me thinking in different ways. And another big theme that I love going on about is that just the simple model of random mutation Darwinian evolution doesn't account for a lot of what we see, and that if you actually look at how species evolve, it's often through hybridization. And I particularly wanted to talk to you in this regard because I wonder how it applies to anthropology. And I suspect the Philippines might be a really great place to think about this because you have so many different cultural and genetic influences. It's almost like the Galapagos Islands of human culture is how I see it. 'Cause can you just roughly summarize like what the anthropological genetic history of people in the Philippines is? 'Cause I probably don't know it as well as you do.
Okay, well, let me talk about it through the story I'm writing, because in 1521, so Europe is already like techno capital is already like expanding there, you know, the and also this is but it's still pre-modern. It's like it's entering modernity. Like it was pretty clear that the world is I mean Magellan. I mean, he's sort of demonized here, but you know, he was like Elon Musk. You know, it's like this guy who is like just maniacally obsessed with like, you know, this his, you know, going to the other side of the world. I mean, it's just like this. He had a bleeding edge understanding of navigation, you know, and then the mapping of the unknown parts of the world. And he showed that, you know, he was able to demonstrate that he truly had that skill and the knowledge to actually understand.
He should he sh if he'd read a few books on interpersonal psychology and power and politics, maybe he would have survived the Philippines.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, this also the thing, like, even now, most our intelligences are limited, and we tend to specialize in a certain kind of way of operating the world. Like Magellan is like one of the early, maybe not early, but he is an example of someone who is focused on mapping truth, creating knowledge, something that could be re replicable. And you see the stereotype of that in the nerd. Like nerds are very bad at reading people. No, that's a stereotype.
Now that you
Yeah, it's
think
like
about it, if he had been too interpersonally aware, he maybe never would have left. He would have been too scared of what
exactly.
all of these unknown people. You need selective ignorance in order for one kind of intelligence to really shine.
Exactly. And also he left Portugal. He sort of betrayed his king, went to Spain. It's like he was just like focused on getting the job done. No? It's like, okay, so it's you have to be blind in certain ways, to do that. It was super risky. I mean, it's like it was like a suicide mission. It's like who would do that unless you're a bit like blind and crazy. So obsession with this particular discipline of like navigation, reading the stars, reading the seas. And so he arrived in what is now the Philippines, in what is now Cebu, encounters Rahaw Mabon. So now you imagine what kind of man could be king in that world. So that is a world, something which people here also do not like to talk about, is like the how prevalent ritual sacrifice and slavery was during that time. But if you're really gonna understand who that man was, you have to think like, what is the kind of man who could be king in that world? So now we are sort of like we pathologize like psychopathy, no? It's like, you know, it's like someone who is beyond good and evil, you know? So but that is the kind of man you have to be in order to be king in that world. And he was supported by his society. You needed that kind of man for you to be protected from other
Are the worst
big
ones.
men. So the these were Austronesian peoples that arrived in the Philippines, and they, in the books, we are told that they replaced, or there used to be what we call now Negritos, which are of like a different genetic origin,
Closer to
who
Papua
came
New
to,
Guineans, I think.
similar to, like, smaller stature. But I was surprised looking recently reading the some genetic studies on the Philippines that they're actually not like Africans. I mean, they were part of the that small group of people who exited Africa, and
Okay.
then
50, 60,000 years ago, they would have left.
So, but like everyone's ancestors outside of the Africans have stayed, right? So it's like everyone's ancestors moved out. That small group was everyone's ancestors, and I also thought, I always thought, because like they look like Africans,
But
that they may be, but
they interbred with Homo neanderthalensis when they went west into Europe. And with what we call Denisovans in Southeast Asia, well, all of Asia, but we now think there's probably multiple populations all through Asia that are as different from each other as they are from the Neanderthals. We just don't have good evidence of them yet.
So anyhow, that was the group that was there before the Austronesians arrived, and so those are the original group, Austronesians. So the hunter-gatherers, the Negrito, what we call them now. So their culture is like similar to hunter-gatherers around the world. They don't bow to any king. So egalitarianism is like they protect that by, and that there's a trade-off there. Because of that, you couldn't have larger societies. It's always small tribes, because everyone's equal. It's hard to organize a society bigger than a few families, no, or one family. So the Austronesians came with that technology of kingship, that you have a strong man, and therefore you could create a bigger society because of that high center and strong center. So this had more classes, this Austronesian maritime peoples. So you have the Datu at the top, and then you have the freemen, the Timawas, and they have also slaves. So it's a more structured society, but at the same time they dominated the what you call this, the Negritos, which so
The Negritos
and then
basically retreated to areas that were completely unsuitable for rice agriculture, I believe, up in the highlands.
in the highlands. So that's the those are basically the elements. And then before the Spaniards arrived, there was like, you could see it in how you could see the Buddhist Hindu influence, because I mean, this guy called himself Raha. That's a Hindu, or like that's a Sanskrit word. Like during the time 1521, that was like 10 years after the fall of Malacca. I mean, that was the regional trading center, and there was a regional language. Anyhow, so I'm so deep into this thing because of this book I'm writing right now. But that's like the world that Magellan came in, and so that's a nice encounter between this world of this power player, Austronesian, with some, Hindu Buddhist influence, very animist still, and then this, Christian, what you call this, a nerd within Magellan. And then the thing is, Magellan couldn't see the game he was playing. I mean, that's my reading of how why he was killed, is because Rahumabon was playing his own power game here. Magellan became one of his pieces that he played with. Magellan was also thinking of his own future as the viceroy of this world. He was going to be like Cortes. But he did not read the situation well enough, and he got killed.
And then subsequently, Philippines has fallen into the orbit of multiple different colonial powers. I mean, most recently the USA, which a lot of people aren't aware of, that there was enormous pressure brought on the Philippines from America before. I mean, who was the last power that was nominally in charge outside of
No,
the
it's like
Philippines?
300 years of Spain. That was like we were in the peripheries of Spain. So like how come like Mexico started revolution like 1810 and we were only doing that in 1898. It's like almost 100 years. And one, what you call this, one explanation could be is that there wasn't that much pressure from Spain compared to Mexico, and also like the local elites, the local power players, like the descendants of Humabon, didn't see any advantage of like being independent versus like working within the system that Spain provided, because we were also throughout those years where we were governed through Nueva España, what is now Mexico, we were getting subsidies of Spanish silver. So it was like it wasn't financially, what you call this, there wasn't a lot of financial pressure until the replacement of the Habsburg with the Bourbons, who were more modern and more like fiscally disciplined. So there was financial pressure for the Philippines to produce the right amount of taxes to be self-sufficient and also to give to the colonial powers. So that is like when the elites that they thought like, it's better that we what you call this, run this place by ourselves. So that's one possible explanation there. So 300 years of Spain, and then there was a revolution here, but then the USA also defeated Spain in their own, I think, in the Cuban War. And then Spain, as part of the being the loser in that war, sold the Philippines for $6 million or something like that. So the Americans took over, and until I think a bit after the war, during the war, the Japanese, like what all this, like for a few years, was the colonial power in the Philippines. And then later on, I think a few years after the war, the USA granted us independence. Yeah, there was also like a lot of like conflict within the US in their own political conversation, like should we be a colonial power? So that was a conversation both within the Philippines and in the US.
Has this history made your people a little bit like the Afghanistanis that like have all of these different empires trying to roll over them, and they've resisted and persisted everything that the planet's managed to throw at them and still come out the other side pretty much themselves?
Yeah, but the thing is like the I think because like so coming from this like what you call this anthropological perspective, like how do people view the past, no?
Yeah,
It's like
how do you conceive that continuity versus the influence of other factors changing you over time? It's a weird, deep question that
yeah.
I
No,
haven't
but
thought of
like I
before.
just I'll just like share how I think about this because it's probably different than how most people think about this. Because to me, you could view the past in different ways, and you could actually choose how to view the past. Now, the default way of thinking in the Philippines is like post-colonial nationalism, and like going back to that psychofauna. It's like why are people why is it the way to view the past? It's because it's advantageous to also a national unity. It's the easiest way to create a common identity is to have a common enemy. So right now the common enemy is this, the Spaniards. It's like it's an easy, like no one's really harmed in a way because like they're already dead. I mean, it's in the
Yeah,
past. Whereas the
it's not modern Spanish. It's a
yeah,
his it's a
exactly.
it's almost like rather than being unified against fighting the neighbors over the hill, you're unified against fighting some mythological demon that is like ever present to serve that role. Like the neighbors
Yeah.
over the hill could like, get washed away in a tidal wave or something, and then, oh no, what do we use now as a
Yeah.
counterpoint to our culture to inspire unity? So yeah,
Yeah,
the past, the mythologizing of the colonial past, like even maybe painting it in ways that aren't always completely consistent with the details of the historic record, but it's serving a cultural purpose today. It's serving an
exactly.
it's serving an anthropological purpose today.
Yeah, so I mean, I used to be like, I couldn't get that because also because coming from a minority, it's like I could, I was like a bit immune to the propaganda of like the nationalist government. But now it's like maybe because I'm older, maybe I'm more just becoming more conservative. It's like, okay, maybe this situation is, you know, it's working. So maybe this way of thinking in the past is the easiest way to get people together. I mean, this nation state is working, so maybe I don't need to like, you know, mess this up. But at the same time, as an individual, you know, it's like okay, that is one way of looking at the past, and that's a way of looking at the past is serves this nation state. But okay, I mean, there are also many ways of looking at the past for the purpose of smaller groups, to help smaller groups. You know, like there are still a lot of like what you call this, like what we call Lumads. We have called them, the indigenous peoples here are, you know, instead of calling Negritos, that those are the new, more politically correct terms, and their individual names that they call themselves. So these are like, I discovered this is the work of most anthropologists now, which is like understanding these different smaller societies, helping document their culture, and also some form of activism. So this story, this view of the past, which is helpful for this national unity, is sort of like also in conflict with the stories that each the smaller groups need to tell and view the world through their lens. You know, like there are groups here which did not really take part in the Hispanization of the Philippines. So they have their own story, and you know, their way of looking at the past, you know, has to be different than the what is promoted in the by the nation state. Anyhow, this is so there's so many moving parts here. I don't know if I explain it clearly enough.
One thing I'd love to delve into a bit more is the application of the idea of hybridization between, I'm used to thinking about it in terms of species, but does that also apply to the hybridization of cultures to cause a like a Cambrian explosion, that you've got all this extra diversity that can trigger a degree of adaptation that is difficult to replicate just through random mutations? Did something like that happen in the Philippines with these waves of very distinct cultural influences? Because like there is still quite a strong European flavor to the Philippines compared to places like, I mean, even Vietnam. Like the way colonialization happened in Vietnam was very separate. Like there were there's whereas I believe there's been a lot more intermixing of European and Austronesian populations in the Philippines. Or correct me if I'm wrong with that. I might be mistaken.
Yeah, I think the genetic mixing is very, it's almost none, it's very slightly correlated with cultural mixing, because like, you know, if you just look at the overall genetics in the Philippines, there's really very few, there's very little European admixture.
I looked it up. I think it was 7%, but I wasn't sure if that was evenly distributed or there, like in some places you'll get
It
like
couldn't
seven.
be. Yeah, it's in the lowlands, it's in the cities that you have a lot of Chinese and, you know, European, Indian, you know, genetic influences, admixtures. But culturally, you know, because culture, you don't need, but it could spread, you know, through education, through, I mean, especially once you become literate, you know, you could just encode all sorts of cultures in your head. So I think those two things could be separate. So in terms of like what you call this hybridization as well, I think while like biological metaphors is like there's a lot of like resonance there with how cultures develop, I think in this case it might be, I don't know, it's like I'm not sure if there's an actual an analog in cultures. I don't know, maybe one example is like how we, I mean, we don't speak Spanish. No, most of us, very few people speak Spanish. A lot of people speak, English, but the sensibility is very like Latin American or maybe Asian. It's like it's a mix of like just by vibes, it's like we go to Latin America, you go to Asia, and then the Philippines is like a mix of Latin America and Asia, just by like just feeling it. I couldn't give you like an objective like explanation why that is, or like if that's really true. Is it like, when I like going to Mexico, I just felt like a sense of like deja vu. It's like am I in the Philippines here? Or so but at the same time, talking to like Thais and all that's like you also see a connection there, like the same sensibility. Some people say even like in Madrid, they feel like the versus the Anglo-Saxon world, a Filipino would feel more at home in Madrid than say in London or some other place. So
I
I don't know
have
if.
a I know a really interesting theory about why Spanish and British colonization went in very different directions, and it's actually based on linguistics. So apparently, with English, it's very easy for colonized people to learn just enough to understand instructions. But English is such a horrible, complex, contradictory language that you really need to be a native-born speaker in order to be able to access our legal code and all our detailed cultural stuff. So that ended with the colonized people and the ruling people who've been exported from England not mixing culturally in a way that allowed prolonged domination and eventual expulsion of those elites. Whereas Spanish is a much easier language because it's more regular. So people who were colonized and enslaved were more likely to be able to claw their way up into the power structure to understand the legal system that had been imposed on them and turn it against the people who had arrived from over the seas. So you ended up with a lot more blending between the different classes. I mean, look at Brazil as an example. It's so thoroughly mixed from all of its influences. And I wonder if a similar thing happened with the Philippines, that the Spanish who did arrive tended to be more integrated into the society over time. That's why there's no real trace of anyone who's just Spanish anymore.
Because the lens I use is going back to like the psychofauna, because like the one I want I prefer to contrast with the Spanish colonization is the Dutch colonization, like in Indonesia. Like they almost left no trace in terms of like what you call this, especially religion, because the Dutch are like very much what you call this captured by techno capital. I mean they're super what you call this mercantile, and like they're very, I mean they're, what do you think about that? Like they're the way they colonized was mostly because of like business. It was pretty much business, whereas like Spain, they always, the especially the Habsburgs, they had this like almost like missionary component in their colonization. So the Philippines, like most of the soldiers and officials were left in Manila, no, but the missionaries went all over the countryside, no, and Christianized peoples. The elites were The sons and daughters of the elites were educated very early on in, the westernized Christian perspective. So I think.
Do you think Catholicism is more compatible with animism than Protestantism? Like Protestantism seems to be the root of like the mind-body separation and the rationalization and scientific revolution. I mean, not that there weren't plenty of like scientific monks in the Catholic Church, but it feels philosophically that Protestantism was much more materialistic in its approach to the world. And I wonder if that was part of the incompatibility that when Protestants went out and colonized, they kept themselves separate from the people that they met because they tended to be more at the animist end of the spectrum of worldview.
Also genetically, like like in Latin America, there was a lot of like genetic mixing. The Spanish, Italian, Portuguese men who went there, married local women, even like the, and this is like, this like just shows like the different worldview in the past, like the conquistadors of Latin America, and their like their soldiers, they had no problem marrying the daughters of the rulers of like of Mesoamerica. No, it was like, it was one scholar told me, like, these guys wouldn't marry or wouldn't like a serf in Europe. But when they look at like the daughter of like an Aztec ruler, I mean, that's okay, I could marry that woman, something like that. So they had a different view of who the other is. So right now, perhaps because of our knowledge of genetics, of Darwin and all that, we create the self or the who we is very genetic. It's like very like, it's about race, ethnicity, and the other is the other race or the other ethnicity. But during the time, it seems to be more like class or like, especially with, like once someone is baptized, that person is Catholic, that person essentially changes. So now you could marry someone who is, it's the same as you. That person is Catholic. So maybe it's the same sort of like mindset that you mentioned. Like, it's like this, the Catholic perspective of like, like once the person is baptized, I mean, that's, we are one church or something like that. I don't know, I'm just speculating here. I haven't really delved much into this, but yeah, you might have a point.
You've got me thinking about founder effects, particularly with the peopling and after the epidemics, the repeopling of the Americas. I often look at the personality of people from the United States versus Europe, and I think about the self-selection that happened with who were the people among those Europeans who were comfortable enough with risk to get on a ship and go to a completely new continent, that's probably, assuming that there are heritable elements to the human temperament, that may explain the difference between Europeans, where all of the, stick in the mud, afraid conservative people stayed behind, whereas the smaller number of like the most wild risk embracing like daredevils went to the Americas and like laid the foundation for the United States. I think that is a reasonable story about why the temperament of those two broad groups of people are very different. But it got me thinking about like the very first Europeans who had that first mover advantage of putting European genetics into South and Central America. They were reckless thugs who signed up to go on this crazy mission of conquest with Cortez and all of those other ones, that they got a head start of a few generations. And I wonder, like, they may not have been particularly reproductively successful back in Europe. They could have been seen as like, dangerous lowlives to be around. But in, I don't know, has that had some impact on
But
the
you have
collective
to also,
temperament?
yeah,
Yeah.
you have to also look at like the rulers of like Mesoamerica back then. They were like Rahamabun as well. Like, you have to be like a bit of a monster to
Yeah,
be at the top
they'd
of
already
that.
been tipped in that direction.
Yeah, so it's so, but the thing is, like, those people tend to be the minority in any society. So I mean, I guess the return to the mean also applies to like behaviors, like tendencies that get passed through genetics. I mean, would there are like exceptions or like exceptional extremes, like maybe psychopathy or whatever. So, but that sort of like tends to return to the mean with like later reproductions, no?
I love this idea of a functioning culture is like an animal where all the cells specialize in different directions but then coordinate with each other. So, like, if you had a human being that was nothing but brain cells, they wouldn't be more intelligent. They'd just be a big dead lump of brain. Like, they wouldn't be able to do all the other vital functions to make how much brain they can support function. And I think human societies function in a similar way. And I wonder how much of it is genetic and then sorting on top of that, because, like, we're not all identical. But I think we underestimate how behaviorally flexible individuals are in the same way that, like, an embryonic cell looks at all the cells around it and says, oh, they're all liver cells. I should be a liver cell too, or a kind of cell that complements liver cells. I think human beings are the same. When we find ourselves in different parts of society, our ability to transform how we function is remarkable. And I think, particularly in the West, we have this idea, this obsession with inborn personality, as if it's this some kind of permanent, extreme, stamped on kind of thing that you get at birth. And I don't deny that there is some element of that, but I think we underappreciate how behaviorally flexible individuals can be in response to their surrounding society.
Definitely, yeah. Well, one thinker that I've been following, David Deutsch, he uses the image of like it's like a almost a, not a blank slate, you know. It's like there are some writing there, but he says like that slate could easily be erased. So meaning you could write something new there. So which might be true. Like you know, we are born with these tendencies which were embedded because of our genetic history, like you know we need to eat, you know we love, we fight, you know, and then through culture those that's molded, and then and you know maybe we could end with this since I have to go in a few minutes. It's like what I feel is like the my work is to like now that you have been molded by society, you're a kid, you have no you like what you call this consciousness yet in your own the molding of your mind. So at some point you're an adult, you have consciousness, and you have like what you call this meta consciousness, meta knowledge, like you know what you know, and you know that you could change what you know, you could change how you view the world. And how do you actually do that? You know, so I mean, maybe the first step is like a one common experience is the conversion, you know, to a religion, a political belief, or whatever. So you had your pre-programming, or first is the pre-programming of nature, then the pre-programming of your culture, and then suddenly you see, okay, maybe I will change it through this. What you call this conversion or this belief in a certain political stance or whatever. But then you could, for you to operate better, you'd want to have also control over like which lens you would use in specific situations. Or even if you're committed to a certain lens, it's like, okay, what are the presuppositions of this lens so that I could be also effective in transmitting this to other people if I believe in this lens. So I think that is the kind of anthropology I'd like to focus on rather than like a lot of anthropology right now is really the documentation of like peripheral cultures and also defending them against this like the forces of like techno capital and modern industrial society. But you know, I think in my case, I'd like to focus on like helping people be aware of the different lenses, the lens per that they have, and also the different lenses that they could take on in order to operate better in the world. That's why I think that informed return to animism is helpful because, you know, we our default way of relating to the world is through persons. I mean, like a large part of our brain has evolved in order to deal with people and like read them and like feel them, empathize with them. So it's like a hack, maybe, you know, so use that to understand these huge cultural forces. around us and, you know, to deal with them, to work with them in order to, you know, do something good with their lives, huh?
That's a really lovely place to finish off. Do you want to let people know where they can learn more about you and read what you're working on?
Yeah, well, you know, just Google my name or search it in Amazon. I have my books there. My Substack is explorations.ph. And those are mainly the two areas where I've been publishing my writing,
I can
three books
highly
on Amazon.
I can highly recommend people check it out. I really love your writing style.
Thank you.
And I'll drop links to all of that in the show notes so people don't have to try and madly type as they're listening.
All right. Hey, Shane, thank you so much for this conversation. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, we were able to go into places where I didn't really expect, and I
Likewise.
haven't really explored. And yeah, yeah, looking forward to continuing this conversation.
Brilliant. Okay, thank you very much for taking the time.
All right.
The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.